This is Where We Live.
How would you define a genius?
A genius is someone who is very smart, very opinionated, and who knows a lot about everything.
Anyone that's an expert in their own field.
People are willing to take risks and actually put themselves to do things, like people who build sculptures are geniuses because they went and made an idea into something.
Someone who has a photographic memory.
Picasso, Bach, Chopin.
I would say Bill Clinton.
My 4.5-year-old daughter is a genius of thinking about other people's feelings.
Stephen Hawking. And Neil deGrasse Tyson.
Albert Einstein, Galileo Galilei.
If you walk around the center, you'll find mad people making music and art, and I define those as geniuses too.
Some voices coming from our interns, Katie Pikus and Anna Novak, who asked some Hartford residents what they think of when they hear the word genius. The chances are, if you had to make a list of history's greatest geniuses, Albert Einstein would show up pretty close to the top of the list. And you probably best know Einstein for his theory of relativity, but his contributions go far beyond that. Coming up today, Where We Live, Yale's A. Douglas Stone, a pretty smart guy in his own right, is going to tell us some more about Einstein's lesser recognized work, something Stone researched extensively for his book, Einstein and the Quantum, The Quest of the Valiant Swabian. But first, I want to welcome in Dr. Fred Lepore to the program to talk about whether the brain of a genius is actually so different from the brain of all the rest of us. You can join us at 860-275-7266 with your ideas about genius and what it means. You can email us where we live at wnpr.org. You can tweet us at where we live. Dr. Fred Lepore is professor of neurology and ophthalmology at Rutgers University's Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. Doctor, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you.
First of all, Einstein's brain, where is it?
It is in New Jersey. Basically, there are 100. At the time of the autopsy in 55, they cut the pathologist, Thomas Harvey, cut it into 240 cubes. There's probably 180 still extant. They are in central New Jersey. They're actually in the pathology department of a central New Jersey hospital. They're not really available for scientific scrutiny, scholarly access. We haven't been able to really get a hold of them. So the lion's share of the tissue of his brain is in a pathology department in central New Jersey. I won't mention the hospital. There's a bunch of slides. There were probably microscopic slides, probably maybe up to 12 sets of 200 that were cut. We might have 600 of those slides located. We have no idea where the remaining 1,800 might be.
It's an amazing story, and before we get into what the slides that we do have might tell us about Einstein's brain, let's go back to this history. Einstein dies in 1955, and there's some conflicting reports about what exactly it is he wanted done with his body, whether or not he wanted to be cremated or whether he wanted his brain or the rest of him preserved for science. What do we know about Einstein's intentions upon death?
He didn't make any stipulations in his will, and I have seen his will. Following the tradition of Judaism, I think he wanted to be cremated. But as things happened, he died April 18, 1955, and Thomas Harvey, who's also deceased, did the autopsy. And Harvey, in a moment of bravado, initiative, genius, if you will, removed the brain and kept it. The next day, in the New York Times on the front page, it said that Einstein's brain had been preserved for scientific study. Einstein's eldest son, Hans Albert, and the executor were appalled. They had no idea that this was the case, that any part of Einstein was going to go through study. Bottom line, Harvey talked to the son and the executor and got them to agree to the concept of studying the brain for science. He kept the brain, and to this day we have the brain. Within a day, Einstein was cremated somewhere in central Jersey. We don't know where where the ashes were scattered. But the brain, luckily for us, I think, has been preserved to the present day.
And, of course, this all happened in central New Jersey because Albert Einstein spent the last part of his career at Princeton. We're talking today with Dr. Fred Lepore from New Jersey, from Rutgers University's Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. He's a professor of neurology and ophthalmology. He found photographs of Einstein's brain. We're going to be talking about what exactly we can learn from the brain of Albert Einstein. When a brain is preserved and then sliced into sections, what can you learn from that? Why is it taken apart in that way, and does it help you get at anything in particular, Doctor?
Well, I think Thomas Harvey reflected, he was a well-trained pathologist. I think he reflected the science of his time, and they felt that if you're going to understand the brain, you need to section it and look at microscopic sections to look at, if you will, the internal wiring, count the neurons, look at all the other cells. So, but he hedged his bets. He took many, many photographs before he did the dissection. So if you believe that the surface of the brain can tell you something about intellect, he had covered his bases by doing those photographs. But I think his bet was that microscopic study of the brain sections would tell us more about genius than just looking at the surface appearance of the brain.
All right, so let's get into it. You've taken a look at these photographs that have been collected over time. What does it show us? Is Einstein's brain substantially different than the brain of anybody else?
Yes, it is an exceptional brain. Now I'm going to refer to Dean Falk, who was our first author and of this study, and who is an excellent neuroanatomist, paleoanthropologist, but she took several months, once we got the photographs, and that's a story into itself, how to get the photographs, but we had these photographs. She was able to spend 2 or 3 months looking at every ridge, gyrus, every groove, every sulcus on that brain, relabeling it and comparing it to, there's a few atlases of normal human cortical anatomy, so she compared them, and she found that his brain is very different. And let me just say, maybe three facts are useful, because otherwise we're just going to be dragging through a lot of anatomy that's not very informative.
But, okay, sounds good.
For starters, if you look at the frontal lobes, Einstein had a fourth frontal gyrus. Most of us have three. So he had a fourth frontal gyrus. That's fact number one. Number two, his brain wasn't bigger. The brain weighed 1,230 grams. He was a 76-year-old man when he died. The normal weight of a brain is 1,400 grams. So in this case, bigger is not better. But the surface of the brain was different. The parietal lobes were different. The occipital lobes were different. He had something called a right frontal knob, which is a kind of, if you will, kind of a magnification of the motor cortex on the right side. But that's not unique to a genius. We think we see that musicians. In this case, we attributed it possibly to Einstein. He was a musician, and he used his left hand to finger the fretwork, and so the right side of his brain, the motor cortex, would have had this kind of possibly, well, either it developed that way, he was born that way, or it developed, or a little bit of both, nature, nurture, we don't know. But the brain, in a word, was different.
Now, this nature versus nurture idea is something that I really want to spend some time with. And I'm getting a nod in here from Lydia Brown, our producer, who put this program together, who's a violinist herself, saying, yes, of course, violinists' brains are different. But the fact of the matter is,
MRI and look for her cortical knob if she chooses.
Let's do that. We'll do an MRI in next week's show. Here's the thing that I think a lot of people maybe don't understand about the brain is that it does change over time, and it can change due to a lot of factors. It's not the brain that you're born with. Explain how the brain can change based on the type of work you do, the type of life that you have.
Well, you know, we know a fair amount about very subtle microscopic changes. You know, the work that Eric Kandel did showed that learning would actually change the wiring of the simple nervous system of a simple organism like aplysia, which is the sea hare. I mean, we know that. But now, if you're saying, you know, if you do quadratic equations and the high abstruse math from your 20s, will the surface of your brain look different? We don't know that. We think, though, that you would have, you know, that the neuronal connections within the brain would change with learning or with conversations or with any environmental experience. Any stimulus could do that. We talk about neurons that fire together, wire together. So there probably are microscopic structural changes happening as we have this conversation. But as far as, does that show up on the surface of your brain with a bigger gyrus or a deeper sulcus? We don't know that stuff.
Mm-hmm. One thing that I think a lot of people, when we ask them about what a genius is, they point to people who have one incredibly well-developed skill, something that they're remarkable at. But then I think we all know people who are very good at one thing but are lacking in something else. Maybe they're very smart in math, but they're not very good socially. When you see the brains of different people, are you able to tell the difference between someone who is incredibly good at math but maybe not very good socially, or the other way around?
I don't think we're at that point yet. I mean, if you show me a bunch of regular MRIs of geniuses, someone who's a great writer or someone who's a great athlete or a great politician, you can't tell. I mean, I think in the future there's a lot of hope behind what's called functional neuroimaging, functional MRI, which shows that when you're using your brain for certain intellectual tasks, that certain parts of it light up. Maybe we're at the threshold of looking at those patterns of activation, and we can make legitimate surmises about the capacity of that brain. But at this point, you show me a scan, I can't tell you anything about that person. Mm.
Now, why aren't there more comparative studies of these super geniuses? I mean, why don't we have all of the great thinkers of our time, those whose brains might be readily available? Why aren't we studying all of them?
Well, you know, we're lucky to have Einstein, and that was a fluke. I mean, there are small series of genius brains. I think there's also in Moscow Brain Institute, they may have some. But when you're talking about Einstein, you're saying, well, I want a peer group, a cohort of comparable, epic-making geniuses. I mean, who are you going to compare him to? I guess you could talk about people like Galileo or Darwin or Newton. For my money, Alan Turing, the guy who came up with the idea of the universal computer. I mean, but we don't, that's nice to say that, but we don't have that kind of comparison available to us yet.
The best studied brain that we've found, at least literature on, is that of Vladimir Lenin. What do we know about Lenin's brain?
Yeah, that's pretty ironic. Yeah, I mean, the political agenda in Soviet Russia at that time was that they wanted to legitimize, their government by proving that Lenin was had a remarkable brain, and they brought in the two preeminent neuroscientists in the 20s, Oskar and Cecily Vogt, and they studied that brain. He studied that for a year and a half. He found some microscopic changes, and subsequently he started to question those. Of course, he was under the gun to come up with positive findings to legitimize Lenin, but the Russians were very interested. Lenin's body created two institutes. The body went to form the mausoleum, and the brain formed the Moscow Brain Institute. I mean, but that actually is probably the best studied brain of somebody who had a high profile of genius, as far as we know.
We're talking with Dr. Fred Lepore. He's a professor of neurology and ophthalmology at Rutgers University's Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. And we're talking about the brain of Albert Einstein. What am I tell us about the brains of other geniuses? In just a bit, we're going to be talking about a bit of Einstein's genius in quantum mechanics. The way that Einstein thought, that we'll be talking with Douglas Stone about in just a little bit, is quite a bit different than others. I'm sure beyond just the brain scans, the brain slides that you've viewed, you know an awful lot about Albert Einstein's life and how he thought. Do you believe that he thought differently than others of his time, other great physicists? I mean, was he thinking in images, say, more than words?
Well, you're right, and you're alluding to his own reference. He was asked about his pattern, his way of cognition, and the question was, do you think in words? And he laughed at that, and he said, no, I think in the, again, this was in German, but I think the translation is muscular images. So you can say that he thought in terms of, what we would think of maybe visual or kinesthetic or not words, thinking in other types of imagery. I mean, that's what he said. But, when you look at the mathematics that he did, I mean, non-Euclidean geometry, which I don't know anything about, I mean, that's not something you feel in your gut or you experience. That's a higher type of thought abstraction. So, he wasn't just kind of feeling that the universe was curved with space-time as a continuum. He could prove it mathematically. So he could probably go back and forth, but maybe between the two worlds of abstraction and gut feeling. But when push came to shove, to win the Nobel Prize, to get scientific credibility, you have to prove this in the language of science and mathematics. And what he didn't know, he learned. Mm. And he did prove it mathematically.
We have just about 30 seconds left, and I'll ask you what we asked some of the folks on the street in Hartford at the beginning. What do you think makes a genius?
Okay, I'm going to punt a little bit. I mean, the easy answer is there's more than one type of genius. There's multiple geniuses. I don't know whose idea I'm stealing that. Maybe it's Gardner, but at any rate, you know, a politician who has social intelligence allows him to be elected to highest office, he's probably a genius. You probably have muscle smarts. You know, the great athletes have it. Obviously, the great composers have it. The physicists who, you know, people like Einstein who can see the universe in a way that no one else could see it prior to him.
So
I'm going to say when you talk about genius, you got to use the plural. There might be 7 or 8 types.
There's probably a lot of them out there, maybe even some listening to our show right now, interested in our next conversation, too. I want to thank Dr. Fred Lepore from Rutgers University's Robert Wood Johnson Medical School. More on Einstein coming up next, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Today we're talking about the meaning of the word genius. Now, Albert Einstein, of course, considered one of the greatest geniuses of the 20th century, or perhaps any century, best known for his theory of relativity. But as we'll find out, Einstein's contributions extend far beyond E equals MC squared. We're joined by A. Douglas Stone. He's author of Einstein and the Quantum, The Quest of the Valiant Swabian. He's a professor of physics at Yale University. He's here to give us a bit more insight into Einstein's vast scientific and philosophical world. Doug Stone, welcome to Where We Live.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
One of the things that I have to ask first is why you decided to write this book. It's a story that not everyone knows about Einstein, but it's still it's a fascinating tale. What got you so interested in this part of his life and career?
Well, it was by serendipity, I mentioned it briefly in my introduction, that I had just learned about some obscure part of his work that was interesting to me as in terms of my own research. And then people started asking me about him, and so I started to study the technical history, which is too hard for, you know, a non-physicist to really slog through. And I discovered all these surprising things about how much he had been central to the theory of atomic physics, of quantum theory, despite the fact that most people thought he was against it, which ultimately he was.
I have a very short quote in here that you have early on in the book, and you're trying to describe the idea of quantum physics and make it understandable to us. Also, make us understand why it's so very important. You say it's crucial to understand that while relativity theory, which Einstein was, of course, well known for, is an important part of modern physics, for most of us, quantum mechanics is the theory of everything. Quantum mechanics explains the periodic table of the elements, the nuclear reactions that power the sun, the greenhouse effect that leads to global warming. The quantum theory of radiation and electrical conduction underlies all of modern information technology. Well, let's talk about that a bit. I mean, tell us more about quantum mechanics, because most of us don't understand it and don't know that it's so central to our lives.
That's certainly one of the main motivations for writing this book, is that in the popular depictions, the weirdness of quantum mechanics is emphasized. And, you know, people have heard the phrase Schrödinger's cat, and they've heard about quarks and the Higgs bosons, and they don't realize that atoms, the stuff that all, you know, the table's made out of, we just didn't understand how atoms worked. Basically, science was at a turning point at the beginning of the 20th century when Planck did his work that starts the book, and we were stuck. We didn't understand the laws of motion of the things that made up atoms. We didn't fully understand what atoms were made of. And a lot of people thought we were never going to be able to understand this because we didn't evolve to understand things we can't possibly see. And it turned out that through this 26-year marathon of struggle that the scientific physics community came through and did come up with a theory, and the laws are all different than what we're familiar with cannonballs and planets. And so it was hard to visualize, and there were some paradoxes in thinking about it. But then once we knew that, we were able to actually manipulate the atom. We were able to make super powerful coherent light sources like lasers. We're able to build a billion switches into something, you know, 10 centimeters across on a computer chip. That's all based on understanding the atoms in a chip or in a laser cavity so that we could manipulate it to do useful things.
And what you write about early in the book is that you really needed to take a leap in order to get here. The leap is not proving that the atom exists, which is something that scientists have been trying to do, but just believing in it. It was almost a leap of faith, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, there were many indirect pieces of evidence, and there was this kind of debate, more of a philosophical debate, about, you know, are atoms just a useful fiction for us, or is there really smallest components and so on of matter? But Einstein was completely convinced, since we're getting around to Albert here, that there were atoms, and he set about trying to prove that they existed, and then thinking how they might absorb light and what the implications were for all the properties of bulk matter made of atoms.
How did he become convinced that atoms were what they were?
I think the way he became convinced is he was a huge aficionado of a part of physics that is a little harder to understand, a little less familiar, called statistical mechanics. And you may have noticed in my book, I do spend time on this. Thermodynamics is another related field. And I was warned that, you know, this is incredibly hard and that people have trouble understanding it. Even you know, MIT undergrads have trouble. And that's true. It is hard, but I've done my best. And certainly some parts of it, I hope, are understandable in the book. But when you try to understand the pressure that a gas exerts on us and all the properties, we're surrounded, obviously, the atmosphere, yeah, if you assume that it's all made of molecules or atoms that are moving around at some average speed and bouncing off you, then you can explain all the properties of gases. And Einstein had fallen in love with that as a student through the work of the famous physicist Boltzmann. Clearly, you can see that in all his letters. And his first works before the famous relativity work were in that field. So I think that's when he decided, obviously, they're atoms, because it's such a beautiful theory that explains the properties of gases.
We're talking with A. Douglas Stone. He's the author of Einstein and the Quantum, The Quest of the Valiant Swabian. It's a new book that helps to explain some of not only the life, but of course the work of this best-known scientist in our world. Now, Max Planck is very well known in your world and very well known overall, but not to the level of Einstein.
Right.
You really start this story with Max Planck and a real problem he was facing, a dilemma of sorts. Maybe you can walk us through this dilemma and how this turns into Albert Einstein's ideas about quantum mechanics.
Yeah, great. Thanks for asking that question, because, you know, that is really how I decided maybe there's a book here, because it's so dramatic, really, to a physicist, a theoretical physicist like me. And the reason it's so dramatic is that Planck, who was the leader of German physics, particularly this area of thermodynamics, was a very conservative man. And he wasn't someone to assume that there were all sorts of new laws of nature that we don't know about. So he was not looking to change physics. And the most simple assumption about atoms was that they just behave like little Newtonian billiard balls the way macroscopic objects do, and that somehow if we just take into account their electrical forces, we'll get an atom. And it turns out that doesn't work at all. And that was the thing people had to abandon, that the laws and the visualization was all going to be different for the stuff that you actually can't see. Okay. But he didn't think that, and he wasn't looking for that. He was just trying to explain the way objects glow when they're heated, basically. And I go into this. It's a very interesting scientific phenomenon and story. But the big thing is he had claimed a certain law that describes this heat radiation or thermal radiation, and he had staked his reputation on it. He had actually said it followed from the laws of thermodynamics. And that's the strongest thing you can say as a thermodynamicist. Einstein himself said that the laws of thermodynamics are the one laws he think will never be violated, which has held up. So Planck has claimed this one law holds, and then finally they do better experiments, and they see it clearly doesn't hold. I even show the graph that's so embarrassing to him because it's so different. His prediction is so different than the data.
And just to jump in, again, he's making predictions. He's a theoretist, and right. You've got people who are now doing experiments and actually disproving this theory, and so he's got a little bit of egg on his face.
Yes. As I mentioned in the book, it's it's a theorist's worst nightmare. I mean— You have said, I know how to do the math. I know how to predict what's going to happen. I'm the greatest expert of my era in this field. And now it's clear you're wrong. You've really made a logical mistake. So it's basically damage control. And so he just gets forced into conjectures. So he conjectures a completely different law that actually fits the data. It's a mathematical formula, but you plot it and it fits the data. And then he has 2 months kind of with the clock ticking to save his reputation, because just conjecturing something out of the blue, that's not science, right? That's a guess. So the thing that he does is he comes up with this crazy idea that you can't exchange energy in arbitrarily small increments, that every time the energy changes, it has to change by like a certain amount, like as if you're pouring liquid into a beaker, but you can only put it in 1 gallon at a time or something like that. Totally crazy from the point of view of classical physics, that Newtonian physics, and very hard to visualize. So, but it explains his formula. You just assume this crazy thing, and it works. But then he buries it. He actually buries the lead, as you guys would say, because he has no explanation for it, and he doesn't want to rock the boat. So nobody says anything about it for 5 years till Einstein comes along.
So Einstein comes along. Why is he entranced by this idea? Why is he entranced by this theory that, you know, comes out of Planck's mind as he tries to save his skin?
Well, part of the fun here is we don't know. There aren't a lot of letters that have survived. So it's kind of working backwards, detective work, to try to figure it out. But I have a pretty strong hunch. Okay, I told you he had this love of this same field as Planck, thermodynamics, statistical mechanics. He was convinced that what Planck had done was a kludge, was just a cheat, okay, a fudge. And he doesn't know what to do to explain this quanta of energy, this chunks of energy and nothing smaller. So he just casts his mind about for something that physically he can imagine that would do that. And he comes up with this idea that maybe light isn't a wave with continuous energy, but comes in little chunks, little particles, which we now call photons, which have quantized energy. And this fits in with Planck's idea and begins to put some real substance to it. So I think it was from realizing he was the only one, I think, that realized that Planck had completely fudged. It was completely arbitrary. It was not consistent with anything. And that meant we were going to have to change all our fundamental theories, like the theory of light, not just some little corner that Planck was trying to fix.
Changing the fundamental theory of light. So this is a big deal that Albert Einstein, it seems from your book, is almost alone in his ability both to visualize, to see, and then to explain. Talk about how he moves these ideas forward in a way that others who are faced with exactly the same information aren't kind of able to do.
Great question, and it relates precisely to this chapter I wrote called Entertaining the Contradiction, because he knows that thinking of light as a little particle with chunks of energy contradicts a whole other body of phenomena, which are interference, the way waves kind of superimpose and either cancel or don't, which a lot of people have learned in high school physics. And that's inconsistent with a localized particle, which can't really interfere. So he knows there's this contradiction, but he's willing to suspend his sort of critical facilities because there are these other phenomena that work perfectly with this assumption. And eventually he just states, way before all the other great physicists, that, you know, the new theory of light is somehow going to be a fusion of these two concepts, some wave part, some particle part. And that's exactly what happened, but it took another 15 years, you know, before anybody, you know, anyone had figured out how to do that. So this kind of ability to entertain the contradiction and visualize some future fusion that's genius.
We're talking with A. Douglas Stone about his book Einstein and the Quantum, The Quest of the Valiant Swabian. We're talking about Einstein and genius in the program today. We'll be back with more right after this, Where We Live. This is Where We Live. I'm John Dankosky. Coming up on Monday's show, Duke Ellington is one of the pivotal figures in jazz. He was a pianist, a composer, a bandleader whose impact lasted well beyond his death. Terry Teachout joins us in studio to talk about his new book called Duke, A Life of Duke Ellington. And we'll bring in some local musicians to talk about Ellington's musical influence on their work. I hope you can join us for the next Where We Live. Speaking of geniuses, we're talking today about the idea of genius. Albert Einstein is a genius, much like Duke Ellington. And this book, Einstein and the Quantum, The Quest of the Valiant Swabian, is a look inside some of Einstein's genius, the genius that you perhaps don't know as much about outside the world of relativity. Doug Stone from Yale University joins us on the program to talk about his new book. I guess I'll ask first, who is the Valiant Swabian?
Well, so the Valiant Swabian is actually a real figure in the kind of folk mythology of the region in Germany known as Swabia, which is sort of southern Germany. And that's where Einstein was born, and he had that accent, and somehow people can tell you're a Swabian if you're German. And there's a romantic poem about a crusader knight, and the poem's called The Valiant Swabian, and this guy outwits the Saracens and the Crusades, and it somehow represents the cleverness of the Swabians, the subtle cleverness of the Swabians. And everybody in Swabia knew this, and Einstein picked it up and started to use it in signing his letters to his wife. And I liken this to me signing my emails, Indiana Jones. I mean, it's just kind of a funny little thing that, I am not afraid. I am fearless. Using this Swabian kind of idiom to get the point across. So because I found the young Einstein such a just charismatic and funny, amusing person, I decided to put that in the title to say, there's some fun here too. It's not just all thermodynamic equations.
But that's what's so interesting about this life too. You go back and forth between the actual physics and trying to explain this again to a lay audience, some difficult concepts that you're able to, but you also talk about the personal, including a lot of the letters that go back and forth between Einstein and other physicists. Maybe you can tell me a bit about what you think you learned about Einstein from just reading some of these letters, this correspondence between him and others in his field.
Well, one thing I learned about him is that in his interactions with other scientists, he's very open-minded and very modest. And, he never sounds arrogant. And, I think we know most of the letters. I don't think I've missed the ones where he's really nasty because they didn't survive. he loves to search for knowledge with other people and to argue back and forth. And one of the things, since we are talking about genius, I thought I'd mention is that Einstein never regarded himself as a mathematical genius. Okay, he certainly was an outstanding mathematician by any normal standard, but he would say, for example, to Arnold Sommerfeld, I love this opening when Arnold Sommerfeld is the great mathematical physicist in Munich at the time, who writes to him a very friendly, actually very praiseworthy letter, praising letter, and he says, "Oh, you people overestimate me so much because I happened by lucky chance to find the relativity principle. But I promise you that if I were in Munich, I would be sitting in your classroom taking your class on mathematical physics." So there's that kind of very human stuff where he's kind of worried that they're overestimating him. Now, in a certain sense, he also knows he's pretty smart.
I'm sure he knows he's pretty smart. But this idea of wanting to explore with other people is something that certainly comes through. Was he universally well-liked? Were others in his field envious of all the fame that he ended up with that all the rest of them, frankly, just didn't have then and still don't have now?
I would say he, until the kind of celebrity craziness hit in 1919, which maybe we could talk a little more about, he was really well-liked. I mean, people just found him charismatic, funny, entertaining, and really honest and a fair broker. If he were wrong, he would admit he was wrong. So I think he was very much liked and admired. And people did understand that this whole idea of changing the theory of space and time is just, remarkable, not to mention some of the quantum ideas, which some of them didn't like because they didn't believe them till they were finally proved many years later. But basically, so I think he was, I don't see it. Much nastiness. There are one or two people who are kind of arguing with him for credit, One of them, Johannes Stark, turned out to be a horrible Nazi anti-Semite later, so there was something going on there that emerged later. Well, so generally he is well-liked.
You talk about that fame that he then later has, and one of the things that's so interesting, especially in our culture today, we're so tied up in what's the latest thing that one celebrity said to somebody else or some ridiculous thing that happens on television. But you write about a time in which the relativity theory was something that was being argued about by cab drivers. I mean, the man on the street was talking about Albert Einstein. Explain that through a little bit. That's amazing to us.
Well, first, I just think that's fabulous. And I'm not sure what would be an analogy in the modern world where people would be arguing about something, you know, that's obviously so mathematical and abstruse. But somehow it's intrigued them. You know, maybe something to do with genes or something now. But it's hard to think of an analog. So what I say in the book is that relativity theory, because it talked about curved space and it talked about beams of light, it was kind of something you could conjure with. It was something you could have an image of and sort of pretend to talk about or feel like you were talking about and understanding. Whereas quantum, which was the other thing he was working on, was just incomprehensible techno-speak, and you know, people couldn't really argue about that. But so he would just besieged with questions because, you know, people were being told our whole view of the universe is different. The universe might be closed. It might not be infinite. It might, you know, et cetera. All these ideas of cosmology came out of his work on gravity, which is general relativity, which was many people think is the greatest achievement in human thought. So that's why people talked about it, and he was constantly being asked. And the quote I actually use, I don't know whether you noticed that one, is he says, well, by now it's about 1921. This has been going on since 1919 when the Eclipse expedition confirmed general relativity. He says, I am sick up to the teeth with relativity. Even something like this pales when you have to talk about it all the time. So he gets actually sick of these questions, probably like celebrities do now, you know.
Well, he gets sick of talking about relativity, but relativity becomes the thing that he's known for, and he turns away from these quantum ideas that were so formative and so, as you put early on, so important to everything that we do now, everything we know now, and certainly the work that you do. Why is it that he turned in his mind away from quantum theory, from quantum mechanics?
Well, relativity theory, even though it was sort of paradigm-breaking, was not philosophically that revolutionary. And he says this. I have quotes in the book where he says, this is just the continuation of the work of James Clerk Maxwell and of so-and-so, you know, a group of people who were all moving in this direction, and I just completed it. And so it's a classical world where cause and effect hold, where if you know the initial situation, you can predict the final situation uniquely, which is the Newtonian classical physics picture of a clockwork universe with predictability. The quantum laws turned out to be not like that, that it could tell you the possibilities of what could happen and even the probabilities, but not deterministically. And that really troubled him. Led to this famous quote that he doesn't believe that God plays dice. Quick caveat, he doesn't mean real God. He doesn't believe in an anthropomorphic God. But he doesn't believe the universe has this non-causal, undeterministic form. So that was certainly one thing.
And it I assume then, speaks to what you and others might think of the philosophies that he had about science. I mean, what's really important in the world of science to Einstein maybe comes out of some of these quotes, but talk a little bit more about that. I mean, what is it he really, at the end of the day, believed that he wanted to do by the end of his career?
So that's what came out most clearly in studying his life and his autobiographical notes, and it's the last chapter of the book where you really get to the essence of his credo for what he was doing with his life. And he felt that he didn't want to spend his life, quote unquote, filling his belly. He didn't want to go around, you know, achieving material success. He wanted to leave some eternal contribution to the knowledge of the universe. And the first things he did, relativity, were clearly that. They were sort of this incredible new picture of our universe that have survived till today. The quantum theory, which in fact he invented three quarters of the concepts, according to my telling anyway, it kind of changes that because it's famous about the quantum that the observer matters, that you know the uncertainty principle has to do with the fact that when you observe an atom, you quote unquote change it. Now it gets into heavy sailing, and I won't go there right now. But he felt that quantum mechanics undermined the objectivity of scientific law. And he had this pithy quote that he repeated all the time, "Do you really think the moon isn't there when we're not looking at it?" That was his way of expressing why he couldn't believe in quantum mechanics.
But it's just so interesting, the objectivity of scientific law, the idea that the observer would change things that much. This is a baseline for why he essentially, well, in some ways, turned away from this amazing theory that he helped to develop.
Completely philosophical, right? Not scientific. Nothing that quantum predicted, basically nothing did he disagree with or thought he was wrong. He used to grumble, yes, I know there's no contradiction in this stuff, but still I find it unreasonable. You know, so it was purely philosophical to see. I think it's an amazing thing that one of the greatest thinkers in human history would then reject this great thing that he had partially created himself and which moved the world forward so much in science and technology. But philosophically, it didn't meet what he thought he was doing as a scientist, and so he just wouldn't work with it.
This idea of philosophy coming into science is a wonderful idea. I'll ask you now a last thing about our big topic for the show today, which is the idea of genius. Everyone thinks of Albert Einstein as one of the first two or three geniuses that come to mind, but I don't think that people necessarily know why that is. They just hear he must be a genius. What does the word genius mean to you, Doug?
Well, clearly, observationally, let's go with the scientific perspective. Someone who thinks of something that thousands of other people have thought about hard and sees a completely different angle or resolution than all these other greatest thinkers is some kind of anomaly. There's some kind of intellectual anomaly. You call it a genius. And in the case of – certainly we try to use genius for something that's also historic that actually changes human civilization. And I would argue that understanding the atom is among the greatest achievements in the history of human civilization. So therefore, you know, because he had such a big role in that, I would say he's clearly a genius. Also, the thing that I was saying at the beginning is really what amazes me. And I'll go to an example of relativity instead of quantum, although there are three or four huge acts of genius that I could go on forever about with Einstein. But with relativity, you see, we knew that electromagnetic radiation, that light and other kinds of things like radio were waves. And all the other waves we knew moved in a medium. So water is the easiest one to visualize. You've got H2O. You somehow disturb it with wind or with a motorboat, and you send out this disturbance through the medium. And the molecules aren't moving with the wave. They're just bouncing up and down. The disturbance is moving in the medium. And the same thing is true with sound wave. That's why in space no one can hear you scream because there's no air up there. Okay. So, but with light, there was no obvious medium. So the whole world went with this crazy fiction. I don't know whether it's crazy. It seems now crazy to say, well, there's an ether. There's some medium that none of us can see. We can't measure, but it must be carrying those waves. And, you know, on one hand, yeah, because all the other waves needed a medium. But on the other hand, isn't this pretty crazy? Yeah. And with relativity, he just said, no, we don't need this. The emperor has no clothes. You know, if you look at this theory, there's no ether in it. He says it very clearly, a little more eloquently than I just said it. So, you know, now that's genius, right? I mean, the whole, you know, 40 years of people saying there's an ether. And even after he said it, people said it for another 10 or 15 years before they finally gave up and agreed there could be waves without a medium. So that's genius.
Well, and the last thing about this, and it gets back to that earlier conversation about his philosophy, is one thing that separates some geniuses, and there are many people in our world today and in the past who maybe have some quality of genius about them. Many of them are good at one thing, really understand one concept or are particularly facile at something. But the ability to both think in the way that he thought, but then also take another level in his philosophy, actually seemingly stand for something at the same time. maybe this puts Einstein in a slightly different category, because there's lots of people who are smart,
right.
Douglas Stone, who you studied for years and years. It seemed as though he had another order of thinking about these things, including his place in the world and what he was going to leave behind.
He's a very philosophical man, and unlike most scientists who are many scientists, I don't want to, you know, who really think that's sort of squishy and not, you know, not as serious. He was always interested in philosophy, even from this time of the Olympia Academy before he was famous, where they were reading the great philosophers, you know, Kant and Mill and so on. And he really, you know, wanted to have a purpose to his life. And so he had this purpose of understanding the secrets of nature. But his second purpose was to promote human rights in very much the modern idea of universal human rights and civilization, not nationalism, not, you know, pacifist. All these very progressive principles were he spent a huge amount of his time on too. So I think he was a man in full in terms intellectually. He really appreciated human civilization. One of the quotes I also sometimes use because he was so passionate about music and it shows his perspective is that people ask him, well, you know, what do you think about the possibility of nuclear Holocaust? He said, I think it would be very sad that we would never hear Mozart again. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he had this kind of view of human civilization and of the higher values, and he lived it fully.
What would you ask him if you had a chance?
Oh, well, the technical thing I would ask him, which I really – it's almost like physically it's – bugging me that I can't ask him this. Okay. So he had a very specific critique of quantum mechanics where he said it just couldn't be true because somehow distant things affected each other in quantum mechanics. This is called entanglement, spooky action at a distance, he actually called it.
Which is a lovely phrase.
Yes. and a very brilliant theoretical physicist named John Bell came up with a test of this action at a distance where it could have been proved wrong. Quantum mechanics could have been proved wrong. Nobody knew the answer. It was proposed in the 60s, I think, early 60s, finally tested in the 70s, retested now for 30 years. Quantum mechanics always wins. Okay, so now we've really tested Einstein's idea in a much more concrete way. And I would like to say to him, well, now that you know about this, would you believe – you know, that quantum has to be the final theory.
And do you think that he'd give you a straight answer? Or do you think he'd evade? Do you think he'd be a trickster about it?
Well, you know, people would come in with him periodically and say, look at this great thing we did with quantum theory. And, you know, we learned this and you know, expecting him to turn around. And he would say, I have earned the right to be wrong. So... You know, I think he sort of just felt the world should be a certain way. But I would love to argue with him about it because we believe that that quantum is this beautiful objective theory and look at all the benefits to human society from computers, from lasers, from whatever chemistry that we do with quantum. So, you know, I say, how can you not, you know, see how great this is? That would be the discussion. I'd probably lose.
It's a discussion that I wish that I'd be able to listen to. I probably wouldn't understand it, but it sure would be fun. A. Douglas Stone is the author of Einstein in the Quantum, The Quest of the Valiant Swabian. Doug Stone, thank you so much for coming in. I really appreciate it.
Okay, thanks so much.
Where We Live is produced by Lydia Brown and Tucker Ives. The executive producer is Katie Talarski. Thanks to our interns, Skylar Magnoli, Anna Novak, Tess Aronson, Jackie Lopper, Katie Pikus, and Jane Ashley. I'm John Dankosky. Have a great weekend.